first met Patrick, he seemed disarmingly normal and just kind of like low-key regular guy. That, of course, is completely wrong.
Now we can actually go after gliomoblasts as stem cells.
He is a doctor, he's a surgeon, he's a scientist.
Gee, that's exciting.
And he's a businessman.
So we should bring Rand into this program.
Patrick's just a Tasmanian devil. The level of energy is enormous.
Wow, okay.
Okay, testimonies from a promotional video for biotech billionaire Patrick Soon-Shiong when he was given the KCET Man on a Mission Award in 2010. Well, now he's buying the LA Times for $500 million in cash. Certainly seems like he is on a mission. Soon-Shiong made his fortune through a cancer drug. Since then, he has used his profits to buy stakes in the Lakers and to schmooze with politicians like Joe Biden and Donald Trump. But while he touts himself as a major cancer philanthropist, ethics watchdogs have pointed out some red flags in his financial dealings. Darius Tahir wrote a profile of Soon-Shiong and his businesses for Politico, and he joins us now. Hi, Darius.
Hi, how are you?
Great, thanks. Okay, so he was born in South Africa, grew up there, and emigrated here, and this is where he made his fortune. How did he become a billionaire?
So it's a long and winding path, as your sort of snapshot gets at. But he was experimenting with diabetes treatments when he found a component of that research worked really well for a cancer drug. And so he was able to convert that essentially into a successful drug company, which he sold later to a couple of biotech firms for billions of dollars.
This drug is called Abraxane. And did he create this drug?
He and his sort of research team worked on the technology, yeah, but it was sort of adapted from an earlier cancer drug called Taxol, which sort of had a reputation for being extremely toxic as a side effect. So the innovation that he did makes it quite a bit safer, I understand.
But he has all sorts of other investments, right? Or he has all sorts of other business interests?
Of course, yes. Basically, what happens is he sells these two companies, and the way he tells it, he wanted to get into some other fields. He now sort of owns a software company. He owns a genomic testing company, and he owns a number of other biotech companies, along with some of the other assets he listed, such as, you know, a piece of the Lakers, real estate, so on and so forth. So he has a pretty sprawling interests, including he manages seven hospitals.
Seven hospitals in California?
Six of them are in California. One of them is in Pennsylvania.
And you investigated how he filters some of this money through nonprofits and for-profits. And is there anything sketchy here?
He has a practice of kind of using money in his nonprofits to sort of boost his other for-profit businesses. We found that one of his foundations, called the Nant Health Foundation, basically the majority of its spending went to other entities, which either put business into him or sort of directly into his own businesses.
Now, the LA Times itself has reported on some problems he's had in his businesses. He's been the subject of a whistleblower lawsuit, some shareholder lawsuits. I think Share even sued him.
Yes. Share did sue him. That's an ongoing lawsuit. Essentially, the accusation there is that Soon-Shiong took over a small Florida biotech startup. And according to the allegations, essentially he and some of the management of that company, they say, tricked the shareholders, some of the other shareholders in the startup, into giving up their shares at a song, even though they sort of knew that this startup had very promising biotech results. And so now these shareholders are suing, and they're also alleging that Soon-Shiong and the management team of this startup sort of lied about them in the press, including in the Los Angeles Times.
Hmm. Well, Forbes, I guess, had a piece out recently in which it says he has a talent for angering investors and colleagues alike. Is that what you discovered as well?
He's gotten sued by a number of his investors. In fact, sort of in the 90s, he did some diabetes research, which later gave him this idea to do a cancer drug. The diabetes research was part of a small startup, which he got investments in part from a pretty big generics drug company called Mylan Laboratories. And his brothers, two of his brothers, were also involved. both Mylan and his brothers ended up suing him in a rather lengthy, rather Byzantine dispute that erupted between these three entities.
And how did he respond to your reporting?
He was not pleased with either my reporting or there's another reporter named Rebecca Robbins from Stat News. And in both cases, he was pretty angry about initial reporting we did in March and April. He sort of started with a pretty long kind of Twitter essay about how the news media was attacking him because he had met with President Trump, that we were sort of attacking him even though he's trying to do a great thing with cancer. Then later, he kind of stepped up this attack in the earnings call, in which he sort of assailed some of the facts in my story, which was published in April. We sort of considered his complaints. He'd also sent a letter to us. We made a correction to part of the article, but, you know, not most of the article in whole. And finally, he also spoke at a conference, a Silicon Valley conference, in which most of the event was live streamed, but not his speech. I was told by the people running the conference that he specifically requested that his speech not be live streamed. So there was a blackout, essentially, in the middle of the conference. Now, since then, you know, both Rebecca Robbins of Stat and myself have continued to report on him, and he has not been as aggressive in contesting our reporting.
From a business perspective and looking at his businesses, why do you think he would want to purchase the Los Angeles Times? And $500 million, that's, you know, even though he's a billionaire, that's a lot of money.
Yeah, no, for sure. You know, I think he sort of likes having cool assets. You know, that's sort of my speculation, but, you know, he certainly owns a chunk of the L.A. Lakers. He's been rumored before to have been involved with purchasing other teams. I believe he was briefly rumored to be interested in the Dodgers before the current owners took over. So, you know, my speculation would be that he sort of likes having cool assets, and who wouldn't want to own a cool paper or sports team or something like that?
If you can afford it, why not?
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. If anybody's looking to contribute $1 billion, I'd like to buy the Bulls.
Okay. Darius Tahir, he's political reporter. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, let's quickly take a journey through the year so far at the LA Times. There was a historic vote by the newsroom to unionize. NPR reported the publisher had been accused of sexual harassment. He went on leave. The editor-in-chief ousted after clashing with newsroom staff and forming a shadow newsroom. A Chicago Tribune veteran takes his seat. All this happens in the last few weeks. So what's to come? Joining us now is Gabriel Kahn, journalism professor at USC Annenberg. Hey there.
Hi, Madeline.
$500 million, that's about twice what Jeff Bezos paid for the Washington Post back in 2013. Is the LA Times worth that?
So, you know, for people who have many billions of dollars, that's kind of a different conversation. But yeah, this is definitely a premium that he paid for the Los Angeles Times and the San Diego Union-Tribune, which came as part of the package. And it's not just $500 million, it's $500 plus $90 million in pension liabilities.
Uh-huh. Okay, so presumably he can afford that. Will he want to make a profit?
So that is my big question, because the only way you're really going to make a profit from this publishing enterprise is through a lot of patience and a lot of initial investment where you first bleed red ink. It's, you know, what you mentioned, the scandals that the LA Times has suffered through just in the past month, that's part of, you know, a very long list of unfortunate events that they've had to deal with. Different owners, you know, nearly 4 years in bankruptcy, the Sam Zell era, so on and so forth. For a decade, no one has really invested in the product. No one has invested seriously in the technology. And so they've got a lot of catching up to do now, too. And that's going to fall to him.
Right. So it's going to be even more than $590 million. It's going to be invested.
Those are table stakes.
Yeah. Okay. And so what do you think needs to happen? What do you think he needs to do to reinvigorate the paper?
First of all, Darius's reporting that you discussed earlier, you know, really, I think, helps kind of color the picture of Patrick Soon-Shiong. He's clearly brilliant and clearly very rich, but there have always been questions about his business dealings. And when he first invested in the Los Angeles Times, in what was then Tribune Publishing, he made a reference that his knowledge of technology and his investments in technology would help power the, you know, Tribune publishing enterprises and help them better sort of distribute and monetize their content. I found that really disturbing, first of all, because it's completely bogus. That never happened, never came to fruition. Second of all, it does suggest that he seen that at the time, at least, he saw some synergy between his healthcare company and this news publishing entity. That would be problematic, you know, for the reasons that Darius stated, because the healthcare companies have been under such a cloud. And what you really need more than anything else in the news industry right now is transparency. So he can easily solve this. He can simply declare that these are two separate business interests that never the twain shall meet, that he is interested in the Los Angeles Times and the Union Tribune because of the civic value and the importance of having a lively, vibrant local paper and what that does for Southern California, and create the proper corporate structure that's going to separate those two. It's not that hard to do. So I really hope that he will do that in the next, you know, few days.
Yeah. And he hasn't said anything about whether or not Jim Kirk stays as editor-in-chief or whom he might hire instead?
I have not heard anything about that. If I had to wager, I would say that Kirk goes. Kirk was very close to Michael Farrow, who was the chairman, who is the chairman of Tronc. Farrow put Kirk first at the Los Angeles Times, then at the Daily News, then back at the Los Angeles Times, all different papers that he owns. I can't imagine, and there's been such bad blood between Michael Farrow and Patrick Soon-Shiong that I can't imagine he hangs on to Farrow loyalists.
So who should run the newsroom then?
Oh boy. So don't forget that they just conducted what was supposedly a national search for their top editor after they fired their long-serving previous editor, Devon Maharaj. And they came up with a guy, Louis Dvorkin, who once installed, lasted only a few months, but within days of taking the job, he had pretty much alienated most of the newsroom. And then, you know, dug himself deeper into a ditch in the days following that. So that wasn't pleasant at all. So, you know, there's plenty of talent out there. They probably could even find someone internally. Of course, it would be nice if someone has, you know, knowledge and expertise in the news issues that face Southern California. But I don't think that's necessarily even the most important question is sort of who becomes the editor. I think it's really kind of, well, he's got an articulated vision for what he wants this paper to do, whom, you know, he wants it to serve. And, you know, I would say that this notion of sort of competing with the Washington Post and the New York Times on national stories is not the smartest move. There's already a lot of competition in that area. California, 40 million people, center of tech, lots of agriculture, trade, Hollywood, et cetera, is chronically undercovered. And they could really, you know, have much more of an impact by focusing coverage in this part of the world.
Okay. Hopefully people are listening to you. People over there in the building. Gabe Kahn teaches journalism at USC Annenberg. Thank you.
Thank you, Madeline.
Coming up, we'll tell you all about those "We Buy Houses" signs you see on telephone poles. That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. I bet you've seen these signs. They're usually stapled to a telephone pole. Emma buys houses. Joe buys houses. All cash. There are usually a few dollar signs, too, and a phone number. Ever wonder who puts them up and who calls them? Well, so did we. Press Play's Anna Scott found out.
There's actually a name for this kind of advertising. Bandit signs. And probably 95% of people who see them have the same reaction.
I think it's a scam. I don't know what street this is right here, but there's like two or three different signs on the post right there. That's not the first place I'd go if I was selling my house.
Yeah, I don't get them. I mean, it doesn't even make sense.
I mean, I've wondered a little bit. I don't have a house to sell them. I assume that it's predatory in some way, right?
When you call these numbers, a lot of the time it just rings.
Hi, my name's Anna. I actually have a kind of odd question for you.
But once in a while, you get a real live person on the other end.
LA called KCRW. So I'm basically just calling a bunch of these numbers and looking for people who put the signs up who might be willing to do an interview.
Most of them say no, or that they'll call back, but then never do. Until finally, I get someone who says yes and agrees to give me the 411 on his business.
I get a simple, you know, a color paper, and then I put my message, and then just kind of put that out.
I'm sitting across from Cesar Espino at a Starbucks in Mid-City. He's 38 years old, talks really fast, and wears a thick silver chain around his neck. He's flipping through a multicolored stack of bandit signs on the table between us.
I have a Cesar by houses. And so these little things here and there that I'm hoping that is going to catch your attention as you're driving or you're walking. I also do it in Spanish. I have other signs, you know, where you have a little house, cash for your house. And, you know, it's all about who's my audience, who's looking at this, whose attention I'm going to capture, yeah. Right? And the color goes into that.
There's a pink one that says cash dollar sign for the S for number four, your house. There's a little illustration of a house.
Correct. Yeah. Yeah.
Cesar's originally from Mexico City. He says he started out in real estate about 10 years ago, investing in rental properties. He's a student of cable TV shows about house flipping and real estate seminars.
Success rate isn't our business. One out of every three. Look to your left. Look to your right. Which one of you is going to be successful? Raise your hand. Oh, now we're talking. That's what it's about, guys.
I checked out Cesar's current company, C2 Real Estate Investments. It's registered with the state, and he started it about 2 years ago.
I look at people that are either stressed, they're going through a divorce, they're relocating, maybe they're downsizing. And so at that point, they want to talk to me, right?
If you've ever looked at one of those signs and thought, wow, you would have to be really desperate to call that number, you're right. And Cesar knows that. Divorce, death in the family, job loss, these everyday heartaches are his bread and butter. Like, he says, the situation with this one house in Carson.
So the seller was actually the son of the owner who passed away about a year and a half ago. So it was a probate property.
I see. And it was in bad shape. That's too much work.
Exactly. Right. And for them, it's, you know, they're going to make an easy money, you know, because, you know, they inherited the property. They never had any debt against that. So, you know, whatever they can get out of it, they're going to get out of it.
Even still, most people don't call these numbers. It can take hundreds of signs to get a few bites. So Cesar deliberately hangs them in dense, low to middle income neighborhoods.
You do want to focus on busy streets, right? I mean, if you go to a high end neighborhood, you're not going to see those signs, right? I mean, you're not going to go to Beverly Hills and see that, right? Yeah.
So you need to have as many eyes basically on your signs as possible. And you want people that are really anxious to sell their properties as right. soon as possible.
Correct.
It's not clear how much business Cesar actually gets from his signs. He says he also generates leads from networking with real estate agents, scouring property listings, and just driving around, knocking on doors. But when he does buy property, he does it all cash by taking out what's called a hard money loan. Then the clock starts ticking to make a profit. Hard money lenders are not banks. They're private companies, sometimes even private individuals, who provide funding to investors and flippers. These loans come with super high interest rates, and they're usually designed to be paid back fast. Sometimes, Cesar says, he'll immediately sell the property to another investor, a practice known as wholesaling, netting a small profit. Other times, he flips the house.
So we actually, what we ended up doing to this house, if you were to look at the before pictures, it was like really, really bad. You wouldn't even recognize it, right?
Like this one in Long Beach near the 710 freeway. It's about 600 square feet, one bedroom, one bath, with an extra detached room and a half bath in the back. He's just put it on the market.
There was a wall here, so it was kind of funky type of setup.
It's got the look that I've seen with a lot of flips, laminate floors, yep. New appliances in the kitchen, kind of a sleek white and stainless steel right. aesthetic.
Yeah, I mean, you know, and a lot of times, you know, you want to be kind of neutral in terms of the color, so you will see a lot of the flips kind of like what we have here.
Cesar says this is a typical project for him, but he didn't get it from a sign. He bought this house from his younger brother for about $130,000. He says he spent another $90,000 to renovate it, and now he's listed it for $380,000. Good deal for him if he can get that. Less so for his brother.
It was a bad purchase to begin with, in my opinion. But, you know, I kind of took it from them, kind of acquired from them, and then I kind of made it my project.
So did he take a loss to sell it to you?
He did, to an extent, based on his purchase price, right? Yeah. But, I mean, you know, at the end of the day, we kind of looked at it, you know, really closely, and I said, well, there is a cost to doing what I'm doing, right, and then renovation. And so, yeah.
Now, there are all kinds of operators behind the Real Estate Bandit signs wallpapering L.A. Caesar is just one example. But if you want to sell your house, real estate watchdogs will tell you to stay away from all of them.
You should be very wary of these folks who are posting the signs.
Wayne Bell is California's real estate commissioner in Sacramento. He heads the Bureau of Real Estate, which oversees licensing and regulation for the state's real estate sales, agents, and brokers.
They're lowball offerors. They're looking for opportunities to flip homes. My advice would be to seek out a professional, licensed real estate person.
Why is it important to use someone who's licensed?
Because they have what's known as a fiduciary duty to the people they represent. They have to put the interest of the seller first. The investors put their own interest first. They're always going to put their interest first, and so they're going to try to get the best deal.
In other words, the world Caesar operates in is unregulated. And if you do a deal in that world and things go wrong, you don't have much recourse. Bell says this world is rampant with scams. For example, investors who try to get people to sign away the deeds to their homes without ever paying a dime. Caesar says, sure, there are a lot of scams in his corner of real estate, but his own business is straightforward. He doesn't deny what Bell said about guys like him. Of course, he's always trying to get himself the best, lowest deal.
If you're not going through a hardship type of situation, then yeah, please go and see an agent. If you're not worry about, hey, I don't mind paying, you know, 3-4% to get some, expert advice, by all means, go ahead and do it. But if you're going through a hardship and you really want to get out fast, I am your guy.
Real estate in Los Angeles is so valuable, it's given rise to all kinds of hustles. For better or worse, in markets like this, people don't just see homes as places to live. Real estate is an investment, a way to get rich, a route to your own little piece of the California dream.
I think it's definitely a very lucrative market, although it is risky. You know, and some you lose, some you win, but, you know, I think that you're always going to have a little bit of profit. You know, maybe you didn't make the 15-20% that you want, or maybe you only made 3%, whatever. I mean, I'm okay with that as long as I know I can get to the next deal and the next deal and the next deal.
So is that your car across the street?
Yes, it is.
What does it say on the side?
So it says, it has a kind of like a bandit sign on wheels. It says, we buy and sell houses.
And under that, a disclaimer. We're not realtors. We're investors. For Press Play, I'm Anna Scott.
Coming up, the story of a young Californian who risked his life to bring coffee beans from Yemen to the United States.
I walked out and I saw what looked like laser beams that were being shot in the sky, and those were anti-aircraft machine guns being shot at Saudi jets.
We'll talk with the man who inspired author Dave Eggers' latest book. It's called The Monk of Mocha, next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. What would it take for you to spend $16 on a cup of coffee? That's what the upscale roaster Blue Bottle is charging for a limited release brew at its shops. Okay, so before you say no way and scoff at that price, consider this. The coffee in question has been rated the best in the world. The beans used to brew it come from Yemen, a country currently plagued by a really, really awful civil war, a staggering humanitarian crisis. And the man who helped introduce this coffee to the United States, well, he faced Saudi airstrikes, near certain execution, and Al-Qaeda to get the beans out of Yemen. He escaped in the middle of the night on a fishing boat that took him across the Red Sea to Djibouti. Maybe now you're a little intrigued by that $16 cup of coffee. The man at the center of this story is Mukhtar Al-Kanshali. He's a Yemeni-American. He grew up in the Tenderloin. That's a rough neighborhood in San Francisco. And his coffee journey is the subject of author Dave Eggers' latest book. It's called The Monk of Mocha. And Mukhtar joins me now. Hi.
Hi, Madeline. It's really a pleasure to be here today.
Great to have you. Okay, so when you got this idea, you were in your 20s and you were working in San Francisco at a condo complex. You were basically a doorman. College wasn't really working out for you. You were living with your parents in this rough neighborhood. And then you came across this idea, coffee. How did that come to you?
I think that most of my life I realized early on that I wanted to do something around social impact. And I stumbled along this old statue of the Hills Brothers, a very old San Francisco company in there.
The coffee company, Hills Brothers.
Yeah, it's right there based near the ferry building. So it looks like an Arab man who's wearing this Arab turban, a beard. He has this long robe with flowers on it, something an Arab man would never wear. But when I saw it, I saw someone who looked like me up there and holding a cup of coffee to the sky, and I started researching and learning about the incredible history of coffee in Yemen. There is actually a port called Mocha in Yemen, and that's where the name comes from. And that's the port that fueled Europeans' enlightenment and brought coffee to the world. And now coffee is the second most consumed drink after water.
So what is it about Yemen that makes it such a great place to grow coffee beans?
If you go on our website or on our Instagram, you'll see these incredible high top mountain villages that are really kissing the skies. And so the higher coffee grows, the slower it matures, and it produces sweeter acids. And probably the biggest impact and why these coffees are so special is that we don't have much water in Yemen. So like in wines, grapes that are stressed produce sweeter wines. And the same phenomena happens with our coffees.
Wow. So you decided to do this research because, well, first of all, it's your heritage. And you thought, well, this might be a good business plan. But when you first got there, there's a funny scene in the book where you're on this coffee farm for the first time and you walk over to an olive tree and you're like smelling the leaf and looking at it as if it were a coffee.
Oh gosh,
it's an olive tree.
you're going to spill the beans here. I walked up and this was, I didn't know much or anything about farming. I mean, I was a city boy. I grew up in, between Bed-Stuy, Brooklyn, and then the Tenderloin. And so when I went to that farm, it was the first visit, early 2014, and we walked up there, and so I'm looking at the leaves, trying to pretend I know what I'm doing. And a few moments later, one of the cooperative leaders comes up to me and says, "Hey, Mukhtar, I'm sorry to bother you, but the coffee tree's over there." And I said to him, I understand that. My street smart skills came in. I said, but these trees are in close proximity to the coffee trees and they affect the health. But
so you're like, I'm looking at this tree critically because it's really affecting the coffee plant over there.
It was a journey. And, and by the way, like I didn't drink much coffee five years ago. I mean, the only coffee I knew was this kind of, coffee that tasted like burnt popcorn, that you had to put large amounts of sugar and cream just to make it drinkable. And when I found out about specialty coffee and this idea of, learning where your food comes from and understanding why this is so special, this special varietal and picked this way, and then it starts to taste so incredible. It was really just one of those things where when you taste it, and then you really understand why it matters that the farmer should be able to be paid better and picked better.
Okay, so you get there, you do your big tour and find out more and more about the coffee and learn and find out about these varietals. And then meanwhile, the war is getting really bad. And the Saudis are dropping bombs every minute, it seems. The Americans are too. The Houthi rebels are also fighting very fierce gun battles and setting off bombs. So how are you negotiating this incredible violence while you're roaming around the countryside trying to find coffee beans?
That's a good question. In the beginning, it wasn't, the war hadn't started. It was, but there were still a lot of issues. There was a, this is Yemen post-Arab Spring. So there was a lot of instability, a huge power vacuum, and a lot of different factions trying to take over. And so there were all these like things happening, shootouts and explosions and, you know, and around me, but I kind of chose to just not pay attention, I guess, or maybe I didn't want to, and I had kind of tunnel vision, and had this project I was working on, these farmers, and, you know, that all changed on March 25th, 2015, when I woke up in the middle of the night, and I heard loud explosions. I walked out, and I saw what looked like laser beams that were being shot in the sky, and those were anti-aircraft machine guns being shot at Saudi jets. And then I went on Facebook, because that's what you do in that situation, and I saw that that Saudi Arabia had begun this military campaign, and you know, then I tried to leave, but unfortunately they had bombed both civilian airports, and I was really in a bad place.
Yeah, so you had to get out because you had this conference to go to present your beans and to kind of make a go of your business, and you couldn't get out of the country to get to this conference, which was in, what, Seattle?
In Seattle. So Dave told me this that I didn't realize, but it took him a long time, like almost a year, to try to understand that question that, you know, but why did you have to leave? And I kept telling him, well, I need to attend this conference held by the Specialty Coffee Association of America. He's like, okay, but why did you have to? I'm like, well, the conference will happen the next week. And then I guess it sounds ridiculous, but like for me at that moment, it meant a lot because I had spent all this time with these farmers, and these are people, these were real people that I knew, and I looked in the eyes and I promised them something, and you know, we're Facebook friends, so I can't run away from them. And maybe also that was all I had left to do. And you know, if I took that out the equation, what else could I hold on to?
So you embark on this what now seems like an insane journey with a couple of guys, because you're like, oh, I have to get down to Aden and get on a boat and get out of here. But that's going through enemy territory and through fierce fighting. One of the towns is like literally on fire and you have to somehow get around it. And then you have to negotiate all these checkpoints. Some of them are manned by the Houthis. Some of them are manned by government soldiers. And, you know, you have to sort of talk your way in and out of all of them. And there's a moment where you're imprisoned, you're held in this horrible jail cell for a while, and then you get out, and then you're sort of resting or sleeping in this seedy motel after this insane day, and you wake up, and there are these guys in your room with AK-47s. Did you think that was it?
That was another one of those moments where, you know, you really contemplate death as a real, like, certainty that like, this is a real possibility. And that was difficult. I remember thinking about my mother and my family and my friends and just how I got to that place. And but yeah, I did make it out.
How did you make it out?
Through a weird series of events, but there was an interview I had done a week before that on Al Jazeera, and a friend of mine, Samar Nasser, an incredible, incredible woman who is in New York, she was there to get married to her fiancé. And so we were both interviewed there, and a friend of mine in Sana'a knew I was supposed to meet this woman in Aden. And so he contacted her through Facebook, and she had family from Aden, and were able to negotiate me to be released the next day.
But had that not happened, you think now, looking back on it, you probably would have been executed.
Yeah, I was in a, you know, and this is a sad part of war. It's so many people are you know, just lost, and just by circumstance and by where they are. You know, me being from in that place, and these people who have lost their family members and loved ones, you know, and it's not that they hate me or have anything against me. It just, that's the kind of the difficulties of war. In an instant, you could be killed. And if it was an accident, it was an accident. And I saw that happen. Actually, the day I escaped Aden, an American Yemeni man, Jamal Al-Levani, from here, from Oakland. He was killed. And so it was a very real, a real danger.
Mm-hmm. So after what happened when you left the Port of Mocha, how you got out eventually?
Well, in that, you know, horrible experience in Aden, I heard one of the jailers talk about the Port of Mocha, you know, this old port, and there were some shipments going out from there. And in my head, I just kind of drifted away and fantasized about the idea of, like, how cool it would be to leave, you know, if I left out of here to go to that port and escape from there. And I made it out. And then the next day, you know, my family was like, okay, you made it out, just stay in Sana'a where it's safe. But, you know, maybe I hadn't processed everything, but I ended up just going to Mocha, to the port, and driving down there for 7 hours and then catching, they told me there was going to be a small ship, but ended up being a small little dinghy, a boat. And I crossed the Red Sea to Djibouti. From there, I got to Kenya and then Amsterdam. And then I made it to SFO here at the airport. There was a press conference for me. It was all these cameras out here and the rest is history.
Well, it's still dangerous there. And yet somehow your business is thriving, operating and thriving?
I don't know if I would use the word thriving, but we're operating, or we're trying to operate. And, you know, for me, there's these incredible farmers with their wonderful, wonderful coffee and amazing stories, and people who want to have these coffees and share these stories. And so it's been wonderful seeing the appreciation and seeing the farmers in Yemen really be proud of something they produced. And that's a different type of payment.
So why does it cost $16 for a cup of your coffee?
You know, that's a good question. And as consumers, we have so much power. We actually have the power to uplift whole economies, you know, and it's so much work. One tree gives you 1 pound of coffee per year. It's about 25 cups. And the amount of labor it takes for that coffee to get to you, it's incredible. And so in our case, you know, $16, if we actually use the price economics of other countries, it'd be more than that probably. But that's how much it costs for us. And that's one thing, this book, The Mocha Mocha, one that I love so much about it, Dave's took this opportunity to talk about direct trade. Mm-hmm. How, you know, for me, it's how much does this producer need to get paid to live a dignified life? You know, and start from that.
Okay, so if I want to taste your coffee here in LA, where can I get it?
In Los Angeles, and Blue Bottle Coffee will be serving our coffees. I think also Intelligentsia will be serving our coffees. And, you know, for us, find the right partners who understand these stories and how to showcase them and how to bring out the best in the coffee through roasting it and how to have the barista. Because the barista is really the last person who interacts with the consumer after this amazing journey. And so we've been really fortunate and lucky to have really incredible partners throughout the world.
Well, thank you so much for speaking with us today, sharing your story, and best of luck to you and to your coffee company.
My absolute pleasure, Madeline. Thank you so much for making the time for me today.
That's Mukhtar Al-Kanshali. He's the CEO and founder of Port of Mocha Coffee, and he's the subject of author Dave Egger's new book. It's called The Monk of Mocha. Coming up, a true crime podcast like you've never heard before, or maybe exactly like the ones you've heard before. That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand, and now a very special story.
When I think about the murder of Haley Price, there are two things that are important. There's what I know and what I don't.
That's reporter David Pascal.
I know that this is the most compelling murder in America, I know that the victim was a supple young girl in the prime of her life. And I know that she was killed by simultaneous gunshot, stabbing, strangling, drowning.
David went to Bluff Springs, Nebraska to look into this. The perfect murder.
It was gruesome. It was unsolved. It commented on the ugly underbelly of the American dream, the decline of manufacturing, modern beauty standards, the gig economy, factory farming, deforestation, saturated fats, the fragility of love, the golden era of television, and CO2 emissions. And most importantly, no one had done a podcast about it yet.
Okay, not even public radio could be that earnest, unless it's OPR, The Onion Public Radio. This week, the satire news site took it to the next level and, like many others, launched its own true crime podcast.
I wondered, where had the Bluff Springs Police Department gone wrong? What had stopped them from bringing justice? There was one thing, too, that really stuck out to me as so odd from the conversation I had with Chief Jameson. He said he didn't have any podcasters on the force. In fact, no public radio reporter had ever so much as looked into the Price case.
Well, joining us now, Fran Hoffner and Ryan Natoli. They created the podcast and they join us from the Onion's office in Chicago. Hi.
Hello.
Hello. Thank you for having us.
Well, it's great to have you. I'm glad you took a break from reporting this really gruesome murder to talk to us.
Quite a bit of damage to our psyche, but I think it was worth it overall.
Okay. So this is your first podcast, right? From The Onion. And you're number one on iTunes today, This American Life, a distant number 12. Why do you think this has been such a hit?
I mean, the genre in and of itself is so popular and felt truly rife for parody.
Yeah. So Portlandia has done it. Other parodies have existed. Why did you guys want to jump into the parody of public radio podcast world?
Well, I think anytime something becomes so pervasive through the culture, like podcasts like Serial and S-Town, when things become popular like that, it's just sort of natural for us to think, you know, what would The Onion's version of this look like? And I think all of us are fans of those kinds of shows, and just felt like something that was not only something people would enjoy, but something that we would enjoy working on as well.
Yeah, it sounds like you're enjoying it. So what are some of the tropes that you wanted to take on in these podcasts?
Oh, boy. There's a lot, but I...
It is finally time to stick it to public radio more than anything.
They've been getting away with it for, I think, far too long.
Yeah, totally. I mean, even though Delicious Dish, it kind of writes itself almost. It's so lampoonable sometimes.
Yeah, but I think we wanted to sort of delve into a genre that had become so popular, both because of and in spite of how macabre and disturbing it often is. It's sort of odd that stories that are so, so dark and disturbing are now popular entertainment.
Yeah, but done in a way that makes us realize how important, capital I, the investigation is.
Yeah, and we're like currently seeing sort of a movement about how crucial and essential journalism is, to a point that I think it gets kind of fun to poke at these journalistic personalities who have kind of become celebrities in their own right.
Yeah, like Sarah Koenig from Serial.
Mm-hmm. But we love her.
Is that number one? When you're thinking of a parody true crime podcast, was Serial number one?
By nature of being the most popular podcast maybe ever, I would say. But at the same time, we didn't want this to be a Serial parody by any means. We're fans of the true crime genre, and the fact that we were putting it into podcast form, you know, lends itself to letting Serial influence it a bit. But we wanted to make sure that there was aspects of all kinds of podcasts in there.
Oh, just let me play a little clip of Serial, which in this context kind of sounds like a parody.
Okay. It's now 2:17. The bell rang at exactly 2:15. Say the fastest she could have gotten to her car is 2 minutes. So that's giving the state the benefit of the doubt, right? If she's really hustling, maybe she can get to her car in, say, 2 minutes.
Remember, her friend Debbie Warren said Hay had told her right after school that she was in a rush to see her new boyfriend Don at the mall, presumably the Owings Mills Mall where they both worked.
I think this is the last bus.
Okay. You know, when it aired, it was so serious, and now it seems kind of funny.
Yeah, I love that episode of Serial. That is like one of the most riveting podcast episodes I've ever heard, that driving episode.
I wish we could have just kept listening to how it played out, because it still rivets me. And it speaks to sort of what Fran was talking about earlier. These podcasts they do such a good job of putting you in the driver's seat of the investigation. And I think it was sort of that idea that we wanted to play around with David Pascal, too.
Right. And so I don't want to give anything away, because there's a twist in your podcast, but he becomes an essential part of the story.
To say the least.
Yeah. Yeah. At the end of the day, it is almost just a commentary about David Pascal.
Who is David Pascal?
In real life or
well,
in general?
Both.
In our world, he is an NYU Tisch graduate who works in public radio. And we sort of fashioned him off a lot of different podcast hosts who both have this really friendly, approachable tone, but also always sound as if they know they're smarter than you. And in real life, he wrote on the podcast a great writer named David Sidaroff, who at a table read read for David, and we were like, oh no, David's gonna have to read all of this.
So was there a particular host that you modeled him on?
No, not particular. It's almost like this character just is David. We've heard him perform and do other videos, and his voice is just soothing in a way that really helps the comedy of reporting on a murder too.
Yeah. And so, you know, it's all super funny. But I think there's like a serious note there that you guys kind of touched on earlier. And that is, we're turning these murders into something for our entertainment. And there's something icky about that.
Yeah. I mean, and that's part of the reason why we would go after something is there needs to be some legs towards saying something about what we consume as a culture and why we consume it. And those are questions that I can't say I have the answer to, because I eat this stuff up just like anyone else.
Yeah. Maybe that's another podcast for you to look into.
Certainly.
Our obsession with podcasts and our obsession with podcasts making fun of podcasts. Oh, my gosh. Okay. So is there going to be a season two?
Nothing on the books as of now, but if people are enjoying what they're listening to and would like to hear more, we would encourage people to go subscribe to BoxBox, sign up for the service, use promo code Haley, and also like, subscribe,
Haley.
As well as go ahead and like, subscribe, and whatever else you do to podcasts, download season one.
Wait, you actually had me there. I thought there really was a box box for a minute.
You can get all kinds of boxes these days.
I know. The advertising is actually perfect, because you've got one that makes fun of Blue Apron. It's called Complete Meal.
Which, I'm very partial to the post office ad.
Oh, yeah. That's a good one, too.
I think my favorite, it's a little quieter, but I think my favorite might be Pizza Fresh.
Fran Hoffner and Ryan Natoli, they produce the Onion podcast, A Very Fatal Murder. And yeah, you can get it on iTunes. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Christian Bordahl. Hello there.
Hey there, Madeline.
You have some listener feedback?
I do. You know, Angelina's been complaining for a while now about out-of-state owners coming in and messing up our paper, the LA Times.
Yeah.
Well, now we have local ownership again. So I asked for people's thoughts about Patrick Soon-Shiong, the LA billionaire buying the Times and the San Diego Union-Trib. Billy Gallego says, same circus, new clown. Adam Jacobson says, bring back the Herald Examiner or the Outlook. The Herald Examiner hasn't been around since 1989. Come on, Adam. Well, Tom S. sent me back a picture of today's paper on his kitchen counter, so Tom S. is reading the Times. I put up a little poll to see if people are reading the Times. 24% of people said yes most days, 35% said sometimes, 20% said not anymore, 21% said never did. So there's a fair number of LA Times readers out there among KCLW listeners.
Okay, good. Hopefully more. In the future.
Absolutely.
Or now. All right. Thank you, Christian Bordahl. Thanks for listening.
Absolutely.
And we'll see you tomorrow.